Hey there. Before we get into the actual episode today, I'd like to let you know about the Obscure History merch store. Generally speaking, I don't like to use this particular portion of the show to self-promote my own things. However, 'tis the season, and as always, a portion of every purchase goes towards UNICEF, because every child in the world deserves to be as safe and healthy as possible. You can pretty much get the Obscure History logo printed on anything. T-shirts, jackets, mugs, skateboards. So go ahead and head over to obscurehistorypod.com, click the merch tab, follow the link, and buy a fun Obscure History gift for your favorite loved one this holiday season. Skateboarding. Love it or hate it, it's a big part of our culture here in the US. You've either done it or seen people do it on the streets, in a skate park, or even on your television. And you might actually know some professional skateboarders, Tony Hawk, Nyjah Huston, or maybe even Bam Margera. These athletes have had their own television shows, video games, and have even competed for Olympic medals. But there's one professional skateboarder you really ought to know, but likely don't. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. I love skateboarding. I'm really bad at it, but I love it. I always have. I grew up right at the height of the extreme sports explosion. At my most impressionable age, I was able to turn on my TV and watch the X Games, and when that was done, I could turn on my PlayStation and play Tony Hawk Pro Skater. It was a great time to be a preteen. It would have been a better time to be a preteen if I had been able to skate, but I was never really that coordinated or dedicated to learning new skills. I knew people who skated. I had friends who were great at skateboarding. And I always looked at them with the deepest envy. But rather than using that as motivation to get better, I just gawked from afar until the trend died out. That's changing now, though. As you probably know, culture is highly cyclical. I don't particularly subscribe to the old cliche that history repeats itself, but I definitely believe certain parts of our past just refuse to stay dead. Particularly the cultural parts of our past. I feel like I'm in 2005 again. I listen to the pop radio station and I hear Travis Barker playing drums on like half of the songs. Fashion is terrible again. Tony Hawk's Pro Skater just got remastered for current video game consoles. And my oldest son is currently obsessed with a fake hidden camera prank show on Disney. It's like I'm living in a Groundhog's Day version of my middle school experience, except I'm older, wiser, and making much, much better choices. One of the great unexpected benefits of this recurrence of culture is that my oldest son is also very much into skateboarding, and we go to the skate park together frequently. So as he learns, I'm learning as well. We go down the ramps together, we try to ollie together, we fail and get horrible bruises together, it's a blast. I also am introducing him to the great punk music that I fell in love with when I was a kid. It's every parent's dream, right? Giving their kids the best part of their childhood and steering them away from their own mistakes with perfect hindsight. I can't imagine it getting much better than that. As skateboarding has become such a big part of my life lately, I've been really interested in its history. You'll be shocked to know that I find it interesting. Because I say that at least once a week, you might think that I believe all history to be interesting, and that is simply not true. There are plenty of fields of study that I'm completely disinterested in, like military history. However, as this is my show, I get to choose the things that I cover, and as a result, I believe they're all interesting. One of the first things that I find interesting about skateboarding is how it weaves into and out of our cultural approval so frequently. If you think about conventional sports, football, basketball, baseball, soccer, they rise and fall in popularity, but they have been a part of our culture basically since they began. There has always been and always will be football. There has always been and always will be basketball. They are very reliable cornerstones of our nation's culture. This is not true for sports like skateboarding, snowboarding, and BMX, though. It's as if our culture has to be primed by some external factors to accept these activities into the mainstream. The first time that skateboarding exploded into the mainstream was in the late 1950s when it was first really created. The true origin of skateboarding is a bit ambiguous. There doesn't seem to be much concrete evidence to go off of. We know that in the late 1940s and all throughout the 1950s, people would fashion makeshift scooters out of wooden crates and rollerblade wheels. These rudimentary vehicles were a far cry from what they would eventually become. Imagine trying to weave through a busy sidewalk on essentially the bottom of a milk crate and some tiny metal roller skate wheels. It would have been extremely difficult. Eventually, the design was refined and the shabby milk crate scooters evolved into thinner, wider boards without handles. Though probably more difficult to learn, these new boards grew in popularity until some cunning businesses decided to get in on the burgeoning hobby. In 1962, the surf shop Val Surf in Hollywood sold the first ever self-produced skateboards. And with that, the craze was on. This great excerpt comes from a documentary that was produced the very same year that Val Surf first produced their skateboards.
What's this, some new kind of dance? Nope. It's America's newest sport, and it's called skateboarding. You say this is nothing new. You used to do it when you were a kid, and you probably did. No one knows exactly when the box came off and they took to riding just the plain old 2x4 with the old roller skates. Eventually, this evolved into the modern skateboard. What makes this modern board so much better is the flexible wheel assembly and the special non-slip composition wheel. This feature allows you to make amazing turns. Look at that wheel assembly flex. These steel-wheeled skateboards aren't so good for this kind of turn. Look what happens if you try one. These steel-wheeled skateboards are toys and aren't designed for the serious skateboarders. Famous surfboard manufacturer Hobie Alter designed the Hobie skateboard and organized a team.
As you can tell, once skateboarding burst onto the scene, a culture and industry immediately began to form around it. This is from the history of skateboarding from Skate Deluxe. In the same year, the company Patterson Forbes developed the first industrial-produced complete boards with more developed trucks. In 1963, the publisher of the Surf Guide magazine, Larry Severson, released the first advertisement for skateboards in his magazine. Also, the clothing industry specialized more and more on skateboarding. One of the most famous skateboarding shoe brands, named Vans, was established in 1966. It was during this period that skateboarding as we know it was truly born. And there is a very interesting phenomenon here. As it was a brand new sport with a brand new commercial industry, history was being written every day. In fact, Larry Severson wrote in that first advertisement, "Today's skateboarders are founders in this sport. They're pioneers. They are the first. There is no history in skateboarding. It's being made now, by you. The sport is being molded, and we believe that doing the right thing now will lead to a bright future for the sport. Already, there are storm clouds on the horizon with opponents of the sport talking about ban and restriction." Considering this explosion of industry, we need to ask an important question. How do new products get traction? There are probably thousands of different marketing strategies, but one of the most recognizable is the celebrity endorsement. In fact, Steve Olensky of Forbes says, "It's not a new idea in marketing. Celebrity endorsements sell products." And while not all brands subscribe to the celebrity endorsement theory, it's based in pretty simple logic. People idolize celebrities, so when famous people are seen in advertisements promoting a new product, audiences are prompted to buy that product, either subliminally or directly. There are methods to fine-tune the effectiveness of endorsements, however, that lead to bigger impact. Here's a look at how brands can use celebrities to boost their sales. The potential positive effects on product sales cannot be understated. According to a MarketWatch claim in Social Media Week, just one endorsement can spell an increase in sales by 4% almost immediately. That's why businesses, even small businesses, would be foolish to resist the mere exploration of celebrity influencers to promote their brand. The effects would be substantial if the brand could find a prominent name who influences their audience. When it comes to affecting brand loyalty, one study entitled "Impact of Celebrity Endorsements on Consumer Brand Loyalty, Does It Really Matter?" found that while the use of celebrity endorsers did not necessarily influence consumer brand loyalty, celebrity endorsements are a powerful and useful tool that magnifies the effect of a campaign. The brand value added by celebrities is immediate and palpable. When a celebrity signs an endorsement deal with a product, an element of legitimacy is suddenly present in the company, simply because of the power of the name backing it up. According to Ad Age, a brand that inks an endorsement contract with a celebrity or athlete can see their stock rise up to 0.25 as soon as the news is made public. This represents an increase in perceived legitimacy from the celebrity's endorsement, even though the product has not changed at all. The same article claims that on average, audiences are exposed to some 3,000 advertisements today across all media, leading to an element of marketing overexposure. Studies have shown that advertisements that use a celebrity, without whom many people already have positive feelings and impulses, grab an audience's attention more easily than a standard ad. Before we get much farther, I think it's important to note that celebrity endorsement seems to be particularly popular in the sporting world. Think of basketball shoes alone. LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, Steph Curry, the list is endless, honestly. It seems like every type of sporting tool has an accompanying athlete signature model. Naturally, as early skateboarding brands wanted to get ahead in this burgeoning and eventually lucrative market, they began running through the litany of marketing strategies: ads, unique products, and eventually, celebrity endorsement. As I mentioned with products like basketball shoes, you might even know some pro skaters just because of their signature boards, shoes, and hardware. Naturally, considering all of this information, I asked myself the question, who was the first sponsored skateboarder? And honestly, the answer is very interesting. And it wasn't Tony Hawk. But before we get to that, we need to pay the bills, so give me about 90 seconds, and when we return, we are getting into the story of the first, most likely, sponsored skateboarder. It's a little tricky to make sweeping statements about who the first of anything really was, and that's especially true when we look at the early history of skateboarding, as it went from hobby to professional sport in the blink of an eye. That said, the earliest professional skateboarder that I could find was a beautiful young woman named Patty McGee. When Patty McGee was 9, she built her first milk crate scooter. She rode it until the handles broke off, which was a frequent problem with such scooters. Then, she began practicing with just the 2x4 and some old roller skate wheels, as many bored suburban youth did before her. As she gravitated away from surfing, which had been her first love, she began building better boards from higher quality wheels and decks that her brother crafted in woodshop class. By the time she was in her late teens, she was already a recognizable star in the Southern California skateboarding scene. In 1964, she broke the world record for fastest girl on a skateboard at a blistering and terrifying 47 miles per hour. The following year, she was a certified pro. And not just a pro, but one of, if not the very first pro. She accepted a contract with Hobie Skateboards to tour the nation and promote their boards, which she did fabulously. As she toured the nation, her celebrity only grew. In 1965, she appeared on the game show What's My Line, as well as the Johnny Carson show, where she demonstrated some of her favorite tricks.
Interesting cover on a recent edition of Life magazine. I'm sure all of you people out there know about skateboards. You probably have one in your home. And it says the craze and menace of skateboards. And with us today is the skateboard champ, the female champ. She's from San Diego, California. She is this young lady right here, Miss Pat McGee. Would you welcome her, please?
Pat.
Patrice Munsell.
Hi.
And Roger Williams.
Hi, Pat. Hey, how are you?
How old are you, Pat?
19.
How'd you get started with something like this?
Well, I took it up because I've been surfing for about 7.5 years now, and I took it up for practice.
For
when
practice?
When there wasn't any surf.
Uh-huh. Right. Show us what you can do on that, will you?
All right. First thing I'm going to do is a kick turn.
That looks easy, but it is not. What do they mean when they say walking the board? What does that mean?
Well, you can be taken two ways. One way of walking the board is picked up from surfing, and it's like this. Another way to walk the board.
Appearing on the Johnny Carson show is a legendary feat, and it helped launch her even further into the spotlight. Later that year, she was paid the equivalent of about $4,000 to film a television commercial for New England Bell Telephone.
This is not an actress. It's Pat McGee, girls' national skateboard champion. And the house is real, not a stage set. Pat's going to demonstrate her unusual method of saving steps whenever the phone rings. There's the phone at the other end of the house. And there goes Pat, out the door and down the hall. Watch the dog, Pat. Good girl. She's skating faster now. Two steps, she can't. What control? The birdcage. She made it.
Hello? Hello?
Well, she almost made it. Nice try, Pat. You know, there's a better way to save steps. Lots safer, too. Get a step-saving extension phone. Order yours from the telephone office or ask any telephone man. Cost less than a quarter a week.
In 1965, she was also featured on the cover of Life magazine. However, at the height of her celebrity, skateboarding culture began one of its many steep descents out of the public spotlight and into the realms of tightly guarded counterculture. She married a man named Glenn Villa and had two children, Forrest and Haley. And with that, her skating days were over, or were at least shelved for a long hiatus. In a wonderful article for OZY, Fiona Zublin highlights Patty McGee's far-reaching legacy, as well as where she is today. Patty was a real icon. One of the first women to gain that recognition on a global scale, says Courtney Payne Taylor, founder of Girls Riders Organization, which teaches and promotes women's skateboarding. McGee is a testament to the fact that women were involved at the highest levels of the sport from the very beginning, proving that everyone can skate. Payne Taylor is careful to point out that male skaters today tend to be very supportive of women in the sport, and women are the fastest growing segment of skateboarders, with workshops nationwide teaching girls how to ollie, which is a trick where both the board and the rider pop into the air without the rider using her hands. But the sport tends to play into the explosive strength of males, who continue to dominate. We don't see as many women in the competitions, Payne Taylor says. On the city streets, though, it's a different story. There, she sees as many girls skating as guys. Even though McGee's skating career tapered off during the street sport years of the 80s and 90s, at 69 she's still very much a part of the culture. She works alongside her daughter Haley, who runs OGBetty.com, a company that makes female-focused skateboards and gear. Together, they hope to ensure a future for girls in skateboarding while fostering an appreciation for the skill and grace that the women of the 1960s brought to the sport. I try to participate and get these old bones out whenever I can, McGee says, though she's done with tricks these days and is more careful to wear padding. Her greatest power, though, is serving as an inspirational symbol for girls who want to take on the wind and wheels. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. If you listen to this show often, you'll know that I normally don't sound this bad. I've been fighting off probably the worst head cold that I've ever had in my life. That might be a slight exaggeration, but it's been a while since I've had a head cold. Maybe I just forgot what they're like, but it's been pretty miserable. I wasn't actually even very confident that I would end up recording this episode today. So I guess I'm happy that I got one out. Sorry if I sound kind of like a like a corpse or something. Anyways, if this is your first time listening, which perhaps it is, welcome. I will sound better next week, probably. I'd like to give a special shout out to Indie Drop-In Network for featuring one of my episodes. If you've come over from Indie Drop-In Network, you rule. You're the best. Well, you're the second best. Greg, who runs Indie Drop-In Network, I'm pretty convinced is the actual best, but you can be the second best. That's fine. All right. Like I said in the beginning, there is always the merch store. New designs are coming soon. I don't have too many personal announcements this week. I'm hoping to get Thursday Footnotes back on track. I was delayed by a couple of personal issues that came up and some scheduling conflicts with some ideas that I had going on, and that seems to all be resolved at this point. So hopefully this Thursday I can get a little deeper into this story of Patty McGee and skateboarding in general. I have a lot to say about this episode that I couldn't include, which is the purpose of Thursday Footnotes. So I'm really, really hoping to get one out, especially for this episode, because I know for sure I've got a lot of things that I had to leave on the cutting room floor for time, and also because I know my audience. I honestly could have gone another whole page or two just on how today is exactly like 2005, but I know my audience is generally older than I am, and so I thought maybe that would be not so interesting to most of you. So look for Thursday Footnotes this week. I can't make any promises about anything in my life, but I am going to try my best to get that out there. So anyways, I've got to get to work. I hope you guys have an excellent week. I'll talk to you later.